This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty. As a ceasefire is scheduled to take effect Tuesday in the fight for the Yemeni port city Hodeidah, fighting between the Saudi coalition-backed government forces and Houthi rebel defenders continued Saturday into Sunday with varying accounts of casualties. Trying to avert an all-out assault on the city, UN-brokered talks last week in Sweden agreed to a truce December 18 with the warring sides withdrawing and international monitors deployed. Senior Houthi official Yahya Saria said his side is waiting to see if the ceasefire begins. He said the hope is the other side will be true to its word, otherwise we are ready to respond. Australian National University analyst Amin Saikal said he is cautiously hopeful this peace process to end the four-year conflict will be different than previous field efforts.
On the one hand, both sides are trying to really strengthen their positions before the ceasefire comes fully into effect. Alternatively, it is a very fragile situation and it could also very easily unravel. But I think there's plenty of pressure on both sides to observe the ceasefire. And at this stage, it looks a bit hopeful and that it could possibly hold.
The two sides have agreed to a prisoner exchange involving some 15,000 detainees and an understanding to allow the rebel-besieged city of Taiz to receive aid deliveries. In Doha, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that without peace, 2019 will be far worse as a humanitarian crisis, with 14, not just 8 million people in need of aid. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir visited Damascus Sunday in the first such visit by an Arab leader since the start of the Syrian conflict in 2011. He was met at the airport Sunday by his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad. The two leaders held talks at the presidential palace on building new principles for inter-Arab relations. The Arab League suspended Syria's membership after the war broke out. This is VOA News. In Sri Lanka, Ranil Wickremesinghe was sworn in as Prime Minister Sunday, just weeks after being ousted by President Maithripala Sirisena that plunged the South Asian island nation into a political crisis. The Prime Minister said it was unfortunate during the past few weeks. Progress and development of the country have been stalled. He pledged a return to normalcy. The man the President picked to replace Mr. Wickremesinghe, Mahinda Rajapaksa, failed to gain parliamentary approval and resigned Saturday. Turkey's foreign minister Sunday said his government is growing impatient with the U.S. over its pending extradition request for exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, wanted in connection with the 2016 failed coup. Mevlüt Cavusoglu spoke Sunday in Doha.
This guy and the others belonging to this organization, 84 names that we have requested the United States to extradite, they should be extradited to Turkey. Well, last time when we met in Buenos Aires, President Trump told Erdogan that they have been working on that.
The two leaders met on the sidelines of the G20 summit. Gulen denies any involvement in the attempted coup. A senior White House advisor says a border wall with Mexico will be built. Stephen Miller, appearing on the CBS program, Face the Nation.
We're going to do whatever is necessary to build the border wall to stop this ongoing crisis of illegal immigration.
And that means
if it comes to it, absolutely. This is a very fundamental issue. At stake is the question of whether or not the United States remains a sovereign country, whether or not we can establish and enforce rules for entrance into our country.
President Donald Trump has raised the possibility that unless Congress approves more funding for the wall, he's prepared to let federal spending authority lapse, leading to a partial government shutdown. That threat beginning Friday. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says he has no plans to extend martial law unless there is a large-scale attack by Russia. Mr. Poroshenko said less than 10% of Russian forces along their shared border have been pulled back. He imposed martial law for 30 days in areas close to the border after Russia seized 3 Ukrainian vessels and 24 sailors in the Sea of Azov, November 26th. In Sapporo, Japan, more than 40 were injured in an explosion at a bar, causing nearby buildings to collapse, the cause yet not known. Georgia's first female president has pledged to work to reconcile political divisions and move the country closer to NATO and Europe. French-born Salome Zurabishvili of the ruling Georgian Dream Party won nearly 60% of the vote in last month's runoff. Iraqis Sunday laid the cornerstone to the rebuilding of the 12th-century Al-Nuri Grand Mosque and leading minaret in Mosul, destroyed last year in the battle to retake the city from Islamic State. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Abate in Washington. Today's Monday, December 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An official of Congo's ruling coalition says the United States has a sovereign right to reduce its embassy staff.
If American authority consider that life in Baghdad is safer than in Kinshasa, up to them to take any decision. I have no comment about this.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for the ruling Common Front for Congo Coalition. Cameroon separatists released recently also want their imprisoned leaders freed. Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF has decided to revive its infamous youth brigade. And South Sudan's government says it will investigate allegations of rape against the military.
We trust in our institutions, we trust in our committees, and we believe that whatever report that they bring will be a credible report.
Michael Makuei, South Sudan's information minister, will tell you why Gambia's parliament rejected a budget and Burundi threatens to sue the BBC over a 23-minute documentary. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official of President Joseph Kabila's ruling Common Front for Congo coalition says the United States has a sovereign right to reduce its embassy staff. The State Department said Saturday that it had ordered non-emergency government staff and family members of government employees to leave the Democratic Republic of Congo. The decision comes nearly a week before Congo's crucial December 23rd presidential elections. The embassy in Kinshasa closed for 1 week last month after it said it received credible and specific information of possible terrorist threat against U.S. government facilities there. But ruling coalition spokesman Andre Alain Atundu says if the U.S. feels that the lives of its citizens in Baghdad are safer than in Kinshasa, then it's up to the United States to reduce its embassy staff.
I can't speak on behalf of the government. The government has its own spokesperson, Mr. Mendy. But considering the decision of American authority to reduce the staff of the embassy in Kinshasa, I think it's a decision of sovereignty. If American authority consider that life in Baghdad is safer than in Kinshasa, up to them to take any decision. I have no comment about this.
So where are we now? There were some fires at the Elections Commission facilities. Any reaction from the ruling party in terms of what happened?
What's happening, we are waiting for the results of investigation. But we cannot forget the statements of Mr. Kamitatu and the deputy Nzang several weeks ago told Mr. Nanga to have a policeman for each machine. If no, he will face the firing of these machines. We just remember this troubled statement. But the most important thing for us is the disposal and the measures that the government and the Electoral Commission has taken to secure the process. And so far, Mr. Nanga delivered a statement saying that there will be no delay for the election. So we are always preparing for the election at 23rd December.
But there's been this concern also about pre-election violence. Any view in terms of who is behind this violence?
You know, European Union put on the table a lot of money in order to delay and to cancel the election. And the Congolese partners are working to make effective the project. That's why they provoke troubles in some parts of country.
That's a big allegation to say that the European Union has put money into seeing that the election are not held. Do you have any proof?
Yes, let me give you a pass. Who organized Geneva? Who organized Nairobi? The man or the organization who made this meeting, is responsible. This is not an allegation, this is an evidence.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling Common Front for Congo coalition. You're speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. South Sudan's government says it has set up a team to investigate allegations of rape and other sexual violence allegedly committed by the South Sudan Army and the Presidential Guard against women and girls during attacks on their villages in Bentiu from June 2016 to September 2017. Early this month, the group Legal Action Worldwide filed a case at the UN Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women in Geneva. The UN Human Rights Council visited South Sudan last week and said it got assurances from the South Sudan government. Information Minister Michael McQuay says the government believes in its institutions and that whatever findings they bring back, it will be credible.
The government actually learned of these alleged atrocities through the media. However, the government set up a committee that will go and investigate and find out exactly what happened. Gender and social welfare went also there, leading a delegation on a fact-finding mission to find out exactly what happened in that place. In addition to that, we are informed that the UN sent a fact-finding committee to the area. We are surprised that the UN passed a resolution which to us was unfair. However, the government is ready to share whatever information with the UN so that all these issues are addressed amicably.
So, Minister, how independent will your inquiry be? I mean, one would think it should have been done by an independent body.
What do you mean by an independent body? The government of South Sudan cannot investigate into any case. When we set up a committee to investigate on the Terena case, it was by the government of South Sudan, and the culprits were brought to books, and they have been tried and they have been given the necessary convictions or sentences. How is it that people tend not to trust in the ability of the government? We trust in our institutions, we trust in our committees, and we believe that whatever report that they bring will be a credible report.
Minister, when the story first came about, I spoke to the presidential spokesman. His first reaction was that this Legal Action Worldwide had a hidden agenda. The fact that you're now going to investigate, is this an admission that perhaps there's some truth to the report?
I find that spokesman of the president was right to say that there was no reason for any. MSF is a humanitarian organization specialized in health services. If any patient has gone and reported to MSF, that person goes there seeking treatment. And the doctor-patient relations, in this case, are definitely violated by MSF. MSF is not here to report on South Sudan or to report on atrocities of South Sudan, but it is here to render health services to the people of South Sudan.
Minister, so is the view of your government that this investigation you are going to launch is going to be independent?
They will be independent, and we have before conducted an independent investigation on the Terrain Hotel crime. What is the reason for anybody today to doubt the credibility of the government of South Sudan? This clearly tells us that those who write such reports have a hidden agenda. And this is where I agree with the spokesman of the Office of the President that the policy of the regime change is not yet abandoned by those people who are here. The fact that we have reached peace and they are supposed to work for peace, but there are some most of these countries which are now backing up this situation are the very countries whom we know very well that have been working for a regime change.
Michael McQuay is South Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Monday, December 17th. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour, barely 24 hours after they regained freedom and reunited with their families. Some of the suspected separatists fighting for the creation of an English-speaking state in Cameroon have called for their leaders to be released if President Paul Biya wants peace to return to Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
About 1,000 Christians sing at the Presbyterian Church in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, in a ceremony to install Pastor Funky Samuel as president of the Council of Protestant Churches and to give thanks for the release of some English-speaking Cameroonian separatists freed last week after President Paul Biya ordered charges against them dropped. Mother of four, Evelyn Akko, says she spent the first night with her husband after 22 months. She says he was arrested in the English-speaking southwest town of Mamfe and taken to Yaoundé.
With him beside me, we can work harder. He used to give me money to support me for my children, but this year they are in the house. All of them, they are not going to school because of him. So this thing has really disturbed us a lot.
Evelyn relocated to Yaoundé to help her husband and says they will only return to Mamfe when the crisis is over. The spokesperson for the 120 people released from detention camps, Joseph Cho, says they are pleading with Biya to also free their leaders if he wants peace.
We have leaders. If these people are released, things will be better. Like Sisiku and Mancho Big Bixi, who were arrested because of this. We expected this decision long ago. Things wouldn't have been the way it is now.
Sisiku is the name given to the leader of the Ambazonia separatist movement, Julius Ayuk Tabe. He was arrested in Abuja, Nigeria, with 46 of his collaborators and extradited last January to Cameroon. They face a possible death penalty on charges of secession, terrorism, and attempting to destabilize Cameroon. University of Yaoundé political analyst Willibrod Zengwa says if Biya frees the Anglophone leaders, peace will likely return to Cameroon. Governor of the English-speaking Northwest region, Deben Chofo, says the government is open for dialogue and the separatists should disarm. The separatist insurgency gained pace in 2017 following a government crackdown on peaceful protests by Anglophones who complained of being marginalized by the French-speaking majority. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF has decided to revive its youth brigade, once considered by critics to be used by the party under former President Robert Mugabe. Mugabe's rule for electoral violence and intimidation of the opposition. The decision to revive the brigade was one of many resolutions passed at the party's annual People's Convention held in Isigudini, about 50 miles outside of Bulawayo, the second largest city. But ZANU-PF spokesman Simon Kaya Moyo says the youth brigade is being rejuvenated so that the youth can play a role in the economic emancipation of the country.
I don't know who calls it infamous, but all I can say to you is that with a very young population, almost 60%, and not everybody, of course, is employed because of the economic situation the country has faced for quite a number of years because of sanctions after our land reform program. But we're trying to say that the youth must not be idle. They must find something to do. And the nature of the youth service we're talking of will be in the form of course, imparting skills, which can also help them to create jobs for themselves and naturally to have a commitment to their country. They belong to Zimbabwe and they have no other country to belong to, and therefore they must be proud of their country. So really there's nothing sinister about this effort.
I know you disagree with the term infamous. It was used apparently in the story because some people say that when this youth service first came about, its members were later used to crack down on opposition politicians.
I'm putting it very clear. I said want to impart skills to the youth so that they can also find means of taking care of themselves in various fields. So there's nothing really to do with the opposition in this matter.
It's said that it's being reintroduced to keep the revolutionary spirit alive. Zimbabwe today, is it still under a revolution?
Of course. It's an economic revolution. We freed our country politically, but economically, we're obviously not yet free. And therefore, the youth must grow knowing that it is them and them alone who can play a major role in the economic emancipation of our country.
Samukaya Moyo, a spokesman for Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF. He was speaking with me from Isigudini, about 50 miles outside of Bulawayo, Zimbabwe's second largest city. Burundi's government says it is angry over a 23-minute documentary made by the BBC, which accuses Burundian security forces of systematically killing opposition members in secret detention centers. The government says it will sue the British media organization for damages. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura.
December 2016. A video is widely shared by Burundian social media accounts. It shows red liquid.
The sound from the BBC investigation documentary named Inside Burundi's Killing Machine, detailing the systematic killings of opposition members by the police and intelligence services in what the documentary calls the secret torture facilities. Burundi's Justice Minister Laurentine Kanyana says the BBC should have first verified before airing the documentary.
The next step is to see our relationship with BBC, what the government have to do. You know, if a person lie about another one, that one who give fake news have to be punished, have to give some compensation to the person who have been victim of fake news.
The Burundi government called a conference yesterday attended by members of the diplomatic corps in the country to watch the documentary. Later, they traveled to the location referred to in the documentary as a detention center. According to someone called Pierre, who was interviewed by the BBC, in the documentary, the house was a secret detention center.
When they finally caught them, I could hear them screaming in a way that suggested that they were being killed or being inflicted excruciating pain. They did not come back in the house after, and given the words I could hear, I think they were killed.
However, the gutter from where the blood was flowing, as suggested in the documentary, obtained from social media accounts, seems not to be connected to house number 76, according to one of the neighbors in Kinindo, but rather connected to house number 28, owned by a Burundian Muslim called Amri Nasor Amri. He says that the incident happened 2 years ago during Eid festivities when he slaughtered 6 goats, and that he saw videos on social media circulating, but he knew it was from his house and that it wasn't human blood. BBC is currently banned from airing programs in Burundi since May this year. London is yet to comment on the government's accusation that the media aired fake news, but the Burundi government said that it will sue the BBC for compensation. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
In the Gambia, members of the National Assembly last week rejected a supplementary budget tabled by the country's finance minister. Parliamentarians said the supplementary budget was not in line with the constitution and that the expenses being sought were exorbitant. Pandere Umbaya reports.
For the first time since the advent of the Barrow government, Gambian parliamentarians have unanimously voted against a supplementary budget bill tabled by Finance Minister Mamburu Njai. The minister wants parliament to approve over 1 billion Gambian dollars to prevent a potential government shutdown. He says the funds are badly needed to keep the government operational. But Banjul North MP Usman Silla says the minister's request is unconstitutional.
They are asking for money to pay for certain expenses, certain things that they have already, you know, already spent. And Section 153 of the Constitution goes against that. That what they should bring before us is things that have not been spent. But they have already spent on it and then want us to approve it. So that's what we've rejected totally.
Protesters stormed Parliament on Thursday, calling on MPs to reject the supplementary bill. Protesters said the bill was misplaced and was not in the best interest of the country. For example, they said sectors such as health, education, and agriculture have been grossly underfunded, while the president's office accounts for the greater chunk of the proposed budget. Sidia Jata is the member for Wuli. Jata says the government's failure to do its homework right has resulted in the rejection of the proposed budget.
Our conscience and the national interest. That should be fundamental to whatever we do here. The Section 112 and the national interest. Nothing else should matter to us here other than that. Even if the whole Banjul is there demonstrating, that is not our problem.
The member for Fonyi Jarol also re-echoed Jada's argument on the matter.
That was Pandere Umbai reporting. Five minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
A very good Monday morning to you, James. We begin with the news regarding the host of the 2019 African Cup of Nations. Egypt and South Africa are the countries bidding to replace Cameroon as host of next year's African Cup of Nations, and the winner will have just 5 months to put preparations in place for the continent's top soccer tournament. CAF announced the bids late Saturday, a day after the deadline to submit interest elapsed, and said that its executive committee will decide the new host at a meeting in Dakar, Senegal on January the 9th. That date, which was pushed back from December 31st, gives the host precious little time to get ready for a tournament which is scheduled to kick off on June the 15th, and it will be the first tournament to have 24 teams participating. Cameroon was stripped of hosting rights last month because of delays with its preparations and a violent separatist movement close to two tournament host cities in the western part of the country. And now to the CAF Confederations Cup and the CAF Champions League, where a couple of matches were played this past weekend in the first round of the preliminary round of the two competitions. In the CAF Confederations Cup, visiting Ghanaian giant Asante Kotoko held Kenya's Kariobangi Sharks to a 0-0 draw at the Kasarani Stadium on Saturday evening. Coach of the Kariobangi Sharks is Williams Mulaya.
I wouldn't bank on the fact that I didn't have all my machines. I do believe that I can still perform better in Ghana.
For his part, Asante Kotoko coach Charles Akuno was happy with the draw.
Tactically, we were disciplined. We made it difficult for them, and good results. We have to go back home, but we're not going to relax. The target is to qualify for the next stage, and we're going to work hard to achieve that.
In other games played, New Stars of Cameroon managed to snatch a 1-1 draw against Al Ahly Tripoli of Libya in El Menza in Tunis. Elsewhere, goals from Alan Kimbardi, Patrick Kadu and Alan Okilo sealed a 3-0 first leg win for Kampala City Council FC of Uganda against Itwiba Sugar of Tanzania at the Philip Omondi Stadium in Kampala. Mike Mutubi is coach of the Ugandan side, the KCCA.
It's been good. I think the level of saturation has improved in as far as we are concerned. We need more of it. And when we have more of it, of course we're going to be a very dangerous club on the continent.
In the CAF Champions League, reigning Namibian champions African Stars frustrated Orlando Pirates of South Africa to a goalless stalemate. In Nairobi, Lobi Stars of Nigeria fell to a 3-1 defeat against Kenyan champions Gomahia at the Kasarani International Stadium. And that's Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. An official of President Joseph Kabila's ruling Common Front for Congo coalition says the United States has a sovereign right to reduce its embassy staff if it wants to. The State Department said Saturday that it had ordered non-emergency government staff and family members of government employees to leave the Democratic Republic of Congo. That is it for this Monday, December 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very productive week.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari host. Let's talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic will be superstition. This will be Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.